Case number 08-5228, John F. Winslow, Appellant versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission et al. Mr. Swick for the appellant, Ms. Lyons for the appellees.
Good morning. My name is Richard Swick. I represent the appellant in this case, John Winslow. If it pleases the court, after a bench trial, the district court found that John Winslow had been unlawfully terminated because of his age. He ordered the government to reinstate him and give him back pay. Now, the Back Pay Act, which governed that transaction, requires that back pay, quote, shall be payable with interest. Despite that clear language, the government refused to pay Mr. Winslow the interest that was due on the back pay.
I can cut to the chase. If this is a Rule 59E motion, and we follow footnote 3 of Usternick, you can't win, can you?
Well,
if I'm not asking you to concede those two conditions.
Yes, we can still win, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because it's what happened in Kroll versus Bulldog in the First Circuit. And in Kroll versus Bulldog, they recognized that there was, that Usternick was dicta, that it didn't change the law.
I hypothesize that if footnote 3 governs, you're now telling me, and it's good enough to come to the next step and do that, but for now, for purposes of my question, if this is a 59E motion, and if footnote 3 of Usternick governs, then you cannot win, can you?
I can win because it's still a question of whether it should be prospective or retrospective, because you're making new law.
So you're saying it doesn't govern.
Right.
But if it governs, then you don't win.
Well, yeah.
You either have to argue that footnote 3 doesn't govern or that this is not a 59E motion. Which one are you arguing, or both?
Both.
Okay, you are arguing both.
Both.
All right. First, tell me why it's not a 59E motion.
Because the fixing of prejudgment interest here is not a it's not something supplemental to what the court has already done. When the court ordered the back pay, it was done. And then the case goes to the government agency that's responsible, and then they're supposed to pay the back pay. And when they pay the back pay, they're supposed to pay the back pay in accordance with the Back Pay Act, which means they pay the interest.
Is your argument that when the district court entered its final order here with a stated intention to calculate back pay, it simply overlooked the interest payment?
In
late 1987, didn't Congress amend the statute to say back pay includes prejudgment interest, right?
It could have been one of two things. It could be that the court simply didn't think about it, or it could be that the court, like the plaintiff, assumed that, okay, back pay means back pay.
District court computed this, right? I remember seeing that had figures laid out on a page as to what each of the elements of the award were going to be. And there's nothing in there about prejudgment interest.
That's correct, but
that was a mistake, right?
It's either a mistake, or it's the court assuming that the government's going to pay back pay interest the way it's supposed to under the back pay.
Well, I don't think you can read the order that way. I mean, the judge tried, is trying to list all the elements of back pay. Isn't your better argument that it was a mistake? He just overlooked it.
It's a
clerical error.
Then it's a Rule 68, and it's certainly something that he should have done. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he needed to, because I think when he said back pay, they should have paid it. But, you know, to the extent that he didn't say
the problem
plus
with
interest
that is, he, the
is appropriate
that is,
under the Back Pay Act?
The problem with that is he says back pay, and then he lists the different elements of back pay, but he didn't include this.
Well, he should.
I think you ought to be arguing it's a clerical error, yeah.
Yeah, he should have included it because it's required that he include it. The one thing that he did.
He had no discretion on the matter, right?
Right.
What do you do with the first sentence of footnote 3? We do not believe that the result should be different where prejudgment interest is available as a matter of law.
Well, that's
seemed to be saying the result should be different because prejudgment interest is available as a matter of law.
You look at the.
That's what footnote 3 starts with, is that that shouldn't matter.
Well, that's the trouble with making a ruling, you know, on an issue that's not pending before the court. Because the court's not in a position to take in
But you seriously think we're going to tell the Supreme Court that's the trouble with doing that?
Well, there's two other circuits that have held that it's a Rule 60.
How many have held that it's Rule 59E?
Well, let's see.
Five or six, isn't it?
Well, the First Circuit held it, but it didn't.
They're not so closely situated as we are. They're not just down the hill.
Well, but also, they don't have the Back Pay Act, the other circuits, the way you do. I mean, Brown's a Back Pay Act case, and it's here because this is where the federal government is, and this is where the Back Pay Act kicks in. You know, in Osterneck, one of the main reason that they say that it should be prejudgment interest should be part of 59E is they look at it as, well, it's really part of the compensation that the plaintiff gets. But under federal—
Isn't that the case here?
No, not really, because back pay is equitable relief.
I'm sorry.
Back pay is equitable relief, and it's.
I thought the gravamen of the statute was to make clear that it is part of the fundamental relief that's offered. It's not ancillary the way the attorney's costs or fees are. It's part and parcel.
It is required, and it's something that is done mechanically after the fact.
If you win on the merits, right, you get the back pay. It's part of the merits.
Well, the district court still can be involved in the term what the back pay is, as the court was here, because they took out for the outside earnings to, you know, reduce it for the mitigating the damages. Mm-hmm. But it's an equitable relief. I mean, the Supreme Court's held that.
But if footnote 3 stands for the idea that if you're contesting an element of the merits determination, you have to go through 59.
Which you're not going in this case. Because the back pay is mandatory under the statute. You know, the
problem you've got there is the first sentence of footnote 3.
The first
we
sentence
do not believe the result should be different where prejudgment interest is available as a matter of right.
Well, that's a statement of belief that's freestanding and not connected to any case. You know, now, you know, let's get some cases in here.
Well, you're saying to us, I think, that we should not follow the Supreme Court's dicta. And I understand that argument has legal validity, but we're biting off an awful lot if we tell the Supreme Court, we know what you think, but we're not going to follow it because it's dicta.
Well, when the Supreme Court's saying this, though, it doesn't have a real case in front of it that involves the issues.
They usually carefully consider what they're saying, though, and unanimous opinion. I doubt it was overlooked by the eight justices who joined Justice Kennedy's opinion.
Well, in the Crowell versus Bulldog, you know, they talk a lot about that. I mean, they actually say, you know, that all the justices agree, and you know, we can't cast aside, you know, dicta like that, you know, lightly. But they do recognize it's dicta, and they do recognize that it doesn't change the law in the circuit. And you know, that's why when they decide that they're going to follow that, they do it prospectively. But in the Kosnowski case in the Fourth Circuit, you know, Judge Irvin's looking at this West Virginia statute, and he's noting that the motion to fix the interest, you know, is not something that's just coming out of the blue, like where the court's going to have to look, well, how guilty was the plaintiff, and what factors should I take in consideration? It's just a mechanical determination. Exactly what we have here. It's mechanical. The judge told him the amount.
You might say it's available as a matter of right. right? I mean, that's what that's...
Mandatory, available as a matter of right.
And again, as
there's a lot of different ways of saying
that. That's the case that the
available as a matter of rights. What the Supreme Court
said. That's what the Supreme Court is describing.
That's what they're saying in footnote three. Yeah. But you know, that as I said, though, it doesn't even contemplate, you know, a statute where it's going to say shall be paid with interest, and it can't do that because it's not in front of it. And you know, I think that you know this court has you know particular expertise when it comes to federal employment, and there's really good reasons why that if this is going to be treated as something that has to be a post-trial motion, it's a motion properly done under Rule 60A. And let me just say, there's no way a plaintiff can do it within 10 days when the order for the back pay is done. And then it goes off for somebody to pay, and then they have to do the calculations, and then you know it's months before the plaintiff knows whether they're going to get the interest or not. You know, and then you know if the interest isn't done, you know, the plaintiff's going to probably work with the federal agency to try to get them to do it.
It's clear from the original order that you weren't going to get the prejudgment interest because everything is laid out, and there's nothing said there about prejudgment interest. You were on notice at that point that there's a problem.
I don't think it is clear. He's telling them what the back pay is, but they're still supposed to follow the statute when they pay it. That's what the statute says, shall be payable with interest.
Yeah, no, it was a mistake that should have been brought to attention. The question is what...
Then it's 60A. If I have no other questions, I guess I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you back a couple for rebuttal if you'd like. We'll hear from the FERC.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Jane Lyons, and I am here on behalf of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I have a few points to open with. I'd like to address the Crow versus Bulldog case that Appellant's counsel relied on in his argument. In that case, as decided by the First Circuit, the plaintiff in that case essentially got a mulligan for any golfers on the panel because there had been an earlier case in the First Circuit decided before Oesterneck that plaintiff could have conceivably relied upon. So in the Crow case in 2004, the First Circuit changed its rule from allowing the sort of Rule 60A relief that it had previously allowed before Oesterneck came down and said, no, now it's only Rule 59E, but this one last guy gets a pass because he could reasonably have relied on our earlier
decision. If we didn't have Oesterneck, let's just imagine a world where there was no footnote 3 in Oesterneck. Why doesn't this fall clearly within Rule 60?
Because, Your Honor, there's a difference between something that's mandatory and something that's clerical. Rule 60A only covers a clerical thing. And I submit to you that because as you've correctly noted, the stipulation agreed to and signed by the appellant's counsel and entered by the court and calculating down to the penny every amount that would be paid or withheld very precisely, and is
now,
absolutely
again,
silent.
Why isn't this clerical? I'm imagining.
I'm about to get to that.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There's no mention of any interest whatsoever of any kind in that stipulation.
And that was a mistake, right?
I don't believe it was, but whether it was
Congress,
or wasn't.
Congress had said by that time, if you're going to give back pay, you've got to give prejudgment interest. So it was a mistake. The question is what type of mistake.
Your best answer may be that it's a legal mistake and not a clerical error.
I actually have two answers, Your Honor. That's one of them.
Maybe it's not your best name.
Yeah, I might have something else. You never know. It's not frequent, but it happens. Now you've confused me, though. Okay, here's the deal. It's not clerical because prejudgment interest being omitted entirely does in a case like this where there is so much going on and so many entries of judgment, when is the judgment? We have no idea when judgment sort of started accruing. That's actually not hard to find because that's when the back pay period is. What is the rate of interest to be paid? That's something, a clerical error under Rule 60A is something that somebody can go back and do a mathematical calculation on. And it's the kind of thing that you see in a case like Poger, where the court's judgment says,
Why can't you do a simple mathematical calculation here? I should know this, but I presume that there's a statutory rate that describes what prejudgment interest is? Or
It's really not as simple as that in a lot of kinds of cases. And
In this case, how difficult would it have been to figure out what the prejudgment interest was?
Well, there's nothing in the record for this court on appeal, it gives any guidance on that in terms of it being so easy that it's already been done, for example. Plaintiff's motion, when they filed it, didn't indicate any particular amounts of any kind. I think perhaps the more important reason, which is my other reason, Judge Sentelle, is that the back pay itself is discretionary in as a remedy and equitable in nature in a discrimination case, and the interest on it is also discretionary. Fundamentally, that's what the Supreme Court and this court's cases have held. So even if Oesterneck didn't exist, it would still be well within the district court's discretion to have denied interest entirely, and there's nothing on the record here that suggests that the district court made a mistake. There's nothing, the record is silent, as it claims. Another point is that because this case is so old and the court file is not here, we don't even have a complaint to see that the plaintiff requested interest in a complaint and made a claim for it. In a case like this, where the district court is sorting out the remedies in a discrimination case, it faces many questions regarding putting somebody back into a position, maybe promoting somebody into a position, doing various things. And as part of that, there are many, many things going in different directions. To qualify under the Back Pay Act, the district court would have to find that whatever was done was unjustified. That's the word in the Back Pay Act. So let's take an example where it's a mixed motive case. And yes, discrimination is found, but there's also a mixed motive in crafting those sort of equitable remedies.
So you're saying that in this case, it was discretionary as to whether prejudgment interest would attach to?
Yes, Your Honor. The Back Pay Act is essentially a waiver of sovereign immunity. It should be narrowly construed in favor of the government as such, and
the statute said it, back pay shall be payable with interest.
Well, shall be payable is an interesting phrase. Shall is mandatory, but payable is not. Payable, it doesn't say in every case where back pay is paid. It
shall be payable cannot be broken into three words and one of them be mandatory and another one not. If that's a mandatory phrase, then it's a mandatory phrase.
I don't believe, and I'm arguing it's not a mandatory phrase. Shall be payable is different than shall be paid. Payable still implies and forces the entity that's making the decision about whether or not interest will apply to say that it should be paid, and that didn't happen here.
I don't follow that argument. I don't see the difference in whether it's mandatory or not between shall be payable and shall be paid. If it's payable, then it's supposed to be paid.
So it's payable if the other...
I don't see how you get that to be different.
Let me explain. It's payable because, and not automatic, because the other...
You get a bill from the government and it says that this tax liability is payable on or before such and such a date at Washington, D.C. Don't think that that's discretionary.
I wouldn't dream of it, Your Honor. Wouldn't dream of it. I'm hoping that doesn't happen. This is very different situation because the Back Pay Act not only requires interest on back pay if the personnel decision is found to have been unjustified. And that's a more complicated and fact-driven analysis than you can possibly just write in.
Do you make this argument in your brief?
Not as clearly as I'm hoping to make it now.
You can retreat to footnote 3.
I can always retreat to footnote 3, which is a good place for me. And maybe I'll just go there and sit down if you have no further questions. Oh, God. Thank you. We obviously request the decision below be affirmed.
Unless you have questions, I'm sorry. Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'm going to touch on, you know, whether mandatory and clerical mean the same thing. I don't know if they mean the same thing, but I know that in this case it's clerical. And
how do you know that?
Because the Back Pay Act says back pay shall be payable with interest. Such interest shall be computed for the period beginning on the effective date of withdrawal of the pay, which is the day he's fired, shall be computed at the rates in effect.
Now that may be why you say you're entitled to it, but we're still trying to distinguish between a clerical error and an error of law. How do you know this is clerical? If the judge does not realize that he has to award that interest, that's not a clerical error. If he had said expressly, I'm not going to award interest on this, that wouldn't be a clerical error. That'd be an error of law.
Well, if he had said that, we would have done something different. But
he did not award it. How do you know that he did not fail to award it? Because he didn't think he had to, or didn't think he could.
He had no discretion not to do that. He had to award it.
And I understand that. that that's your argument. What I don't know is, did the judge fail to award it because he made an error of law or because he made a clerical error?
Well, I have to assume the judge is acting in good faith.
We don't have to assume that he knows everything, though. Judges act in good faith, and we reverse them fairly frequently.
So when he
every now and then the Supreme Court reverses us, and we don't ever act in bad faith.
When he doesn't do what he's supposed to, you know, I think here that it's simply probably because it didn't occur to him. Maybe, you know, the change was new, and maybe that's why he didn't do it. But
it didn't occur to him because he didn't know he could do it. It was new, like you say. It's an error of law.
But I don't think it's an error of law, though, because the statute still said what it says. And when he ordered the back pay, the statute says it still says it shall be payable. It tells what the rate's going to be and when it's going to be calculated. You don't need a new determination by a judge to do that. You need a computer program. And, you know, the government has those, and they should have put it into the program and paid this. I don't think that there was any discretion at all on it. And I don't think that it was a error that needed to be corrected. It was simply something that was left out.
It seems to be our habit. We've talked to you past your time limits. So unless my colleagues have further questions, case is submitted.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.